Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk about the Stanford sexual assault case. Quick background here. Last week, former Stanford University student Brock Turner was found guilty of sexually assaulting an intoxicated, unconscious woman at a campus frat party. She was found behind a dumpster by two passersby. Turner was sentenced to 6 months in jail with probation, a sentence that outraged many. The victim wrote a powerful and brave 12-page impact statement, which included a direct challenge to Turner's claim that alcohol was to blame. She wrote, "Is it a factor? Yes, but we were both drunk. The difference is I did not take off your pants and underwear, touch you inappropriately, and run away. That's the difference." Then came the statement from Brock Turner's father, Dan Turner. He wrote the court begging leniency for his son, saying, "His life will never be the one he dreamed about and worked so hard to achieve. That is a steep price to pay for 20 minutes of action out of 20-plus years of his life." Well, thousands, maybe millions of people recoiled at that. Huffington Post contributor and parenting blogger Whitney Fleming wrote an open letter to Dan Turner. "It comes down to us, the parents, Mr. Turner," she writes. "It's up to you to help your son see his wrongdoings. Unfortunately, because you do not hold your son accountable for the rape, you are part of the rape culture, Mr. Turner. You are the problem." Well, that's what we want to talk about right now, about parenting, about entitlement, about teaching respect, dignity, and accountability. And we want to hear from you. What was your reaction to Dan Turner's defense of his son? What are we as mothers and fathers teaching young men, and what should we be teaching them, and how? Are parents part of the problem of rape culture? Call us with your thoughts. I want to know them. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Well, joining us to help think through this is Michael Thompson. He's the author of Raising Cain, Protecting the Emotional Life of Boys. Michael, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna.
Also with us in the studio is Megara Bell. She's the founder and director of Partners in Sex Education, a sexual education group based in Newton. Megara Bell, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, let me just get the quick reaction from both of you. Again, we're focusing on the parenting side of this and the teaching of young men. So what was your reaction to Dan Turner's statement in defense of his son in the Stanford case, Michael?
I was appalled and deeply discouraged. The father was completely rationalizing a crime his son had committed, and the father was totally unable to empathize with the victim of his son's crime. Would this father have felt differently if his son had been found behind a dumpster, half undressed, and his son had been digitally penetrated by somebody? Of course he would have had a different reaction. He would have been enraged. But when his son did it to somebody else, he completely rationalized it. You know, 20 minutes of action. What a terrible phrase.
Mm. Well, I mean, he later wrote in the Huffington Post that he regretted his choice of words and didn't necessarily mean action in terms of sexual action. But nevertheless, he wrote that original letter. And even beyond that, Megara, and I'm sorry I mispronounced your name earlier, as Michael was saying, I read Dan Turner's letter and I really failed to see any sympathy or empathy for the victim, and that was the major thing that was lacking in this letter. And I just wonder what your response is to that.
Well, that's basically the problem. If we're not looking at it with some sympathy or some understanding or some empathy for the victims, and we're just worried about what the perpetrators feel about this, we're apologizing for it. And we're allowing, we're letting the culture, and we're letting allowing it. And what we're saying to our boys is that it doesn't matter. It only matters if they get caught.
Mm-hmm. So both of you, tell me more about this, because again, I referenced Whitney Fleming. She's a parenting blogger and a writer for Huffington Post, and her open letter that she wrote to Dan Turner. I mean, I feel like she said it more passionately and more eloquently than possibly I'm even capable of. But she said, you know, "Because you and your son are not acknowledging his actions, the culture of rape at our colleges continues to grow. You are part of the problem." I mean, is that In this case, maybe because it is so clear what happened, one can say that. But more broadly, I mean, is how people we are parenting our young boys, is it part of the problem?
Well, Magara and I both do sex education, but I always ask a group of boys when I start to teach them about sex, how many of you have had meaningful discussions with your parents? And a 14-year-old boy, three-quarters of them have never had a meaningful discussion about sex with their parents. So we don't have to target parents who actively rationalize, you know, boys will be boys and what they do, what can, you know, their impulses, they can't control, whatever. Those kinds of really unattractive rationalizations are. It's simply the passivity of parents. And boys age 12 to 25 are the biggest consumers of pornography. And if your parents never talk to you about sexuality, about your sexuality, about the possibility of relationships and the intensity of your sexual desire and how that's going to play out, you're going to get your education from the internet.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly the problem, is that if our parents are not talking to our kids and the schools, and by and large, most of the schools are not providing sex education. We're working with a lot of schools that are, and kudos to them, but many, many, many schools are not providing anything. So they're not getting anything from their families. They're not getting anything from the schools. And so where do young people go for information? They do. They go to the internet. And what's being provided on the internet about sexuality is not always educational. Mm. And it's not meant to be educational. And it's providing a framework for sexuality that is not helpful in any way for these young developing men and women.
Well, we are talking about the Stanford sexual assault case and the myriad questions that have been raised based on not only the victim's eloquent impact statement, but the reaction from Brock Turner, the perpetrator of the assaults, his father, and his father's letter to the judge, the sentencing judge, asking the judge for lenience in this case, saying that his son has been irrevocably harmed by what happened, and that it's clear that his son was trying to fit into the culture of Stanford University and that he has no prior criminal history. In the letter, Dan Turner says of his son, he has no prior criminal history and has never been so violent to anyone, including his actions of the night of January 17th, 2015. So when a parent writes a letter with those kind of words and assertions in it, even after a young man has been found guilty unanimously by a jury of sexual assault, what does it mean about how that young man was parented? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Send us your comments at Twitter at Radio Boston as well. Michael and Megara, I do want to ask you something else specifically that the victim brought up in her impact statement, because she talked about how Brock Turner had told authorities that if he felt she had been responsive in some way, that he would have stopped, which is an implication that, you know, that, I mean, she was totally unresponsive. And so therefore, you know, he continued his actions. And I still have trouble wrapping my head around that here's a young man who was looking for a flutter of an eyelid, and that would be enough to tell him to stop. But because she was unresponsive, he felt that his actions were okay. I mean, it's hard to understand.
It's strange belief, doesn't
yeah.
it? I mean, but so much of the position he took in defending himself, and that he was clearly supported in taking by his lawyers. And what was so profoundly moving about the victim's statement was that not only had she been raped, but then the whole year of moving to this trial and his statements was she said, "You made me live this night after night after night because you would not take responsibility." I mean, everybody should read the statement that she wrote. It is so beautifully written and so admirable and courageous. Mm. And the fact she delivered it to Brock Turner in face-to-face, amazing.
Megara?
We spend a lot of time talking about consent in schools and all of the curricula in middle school and in high school and in colleges. We frame it in terms of consent. I think it's incredibly important. And when we talk about consent to young people, we talk about some of the difficulties because it's not easy. It is complicated. Communication is complicated and figuring out what another person wants. That said, this particular case was not about a nuance of consent.
Right.
any one of my students, any 12-year-old, could tell you so clearly that having sex with an unresponsive person behind a dumpster was a rape. That is not something that we need to flesh out in terms of the ethics of it. The only person that would claim that that could potentially be a consensual situation would be a defendant in a rape case or their lawyer. But in general, that is not something that is generally accepted by the culture. And so teaching consent, we know that that's not consent. Teaching consent, I'm hoping, will reframe the way we talk about it in the culture, reframe the way people are addressing it, reframe with maybe the way the judge looked at it, maybe the way the parents look at it.
Michael, I'm going to get I'm going to come back to you in just a second, but I also want to just talk for a second about how even in this clear-cut case, things are still being framed very differently between, Brock Turner's father and the victim. I mean, Dan Turner wrote again in his statement to the court, he said, asking the judge for leniency, saying, by having people like Brock educate others on college campuses, that's how society can begin to break the cycle of binge drinking and its unfortunate results. So still framing it as, quote unquote, the unfortunate result of binge drinking, whereas the victim writes in her statement, if you want to talk to high school kids about drinking, go to an AA meeting. You realize that having a drinking problem is different than drinking, than forcefully trying to have sex with somebody. And this is where I feel like, why are we still having this conversation with alcohol first and then putting the violent action second?
Why, indeed. And the victim says there were other drunk people at the party, but they weren't raping people. Brock Turner was. Drinking. Now, it is important when we teach about consent. There's an old generational change. When I was growing up and a teenage boy, rape was something that had to be forcible. Then it changed over the course of my lifetime to no means no. We have a new standard, which is yes means yes. That's going to require more education of girls and more education of boys. But we also have to teach kids that what you do when you're drunk is not excusable. And that has to be talked about. And it has to be talked about by parents to their kids. But then you have to admit your child's sexual and your child may in fact be drinking. Well, big surprise, they're in college.
Yeah. Well, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So Michael and Megara, if you could just hold on for 1 second, I am going to try and get these callers in here. Let's go to Sarah, who's calling from Newton. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot for having this important topic. I read the book about raising boys as well. So I have a 16-year-old and a 21-year-old, and I've really tried very hard speaking to them about this all their life. And they have a wonderful dad who's the most gentle man. And a couple months ago when that whole thing, I think it was about a year ago, when the St. Paul's event was, I brought it up again among a brunch at our house where a couple of their friends were, their cousins were. And it's so difficult to bring it up, and I was shocked to see the reactions of these boys was basically, we're with the boy, and I basically almost fell off my chair, but held my ground and talked about it for about an hour, and I was the only woman at the table. They kind of made fun of me for the first 20 minutes, like, you're a feminist, you went to an all-girls college, you know, all this kind of stuff. But then it was interesting, the next day, they all of them, including the visitors, came to me and said, you know, you're kind of right. We've really thought about this, and you're right. So I think it's really a painful conversation, but necessary.
Right.
And it's really hard to do right. when you're the woman.
Sarah, I'm going to just jump in here because I really appreciate your call, and I want Michael and Megara's response to that. So thank you for calling. One thing that Sarah's story raises in my mind is, how do you have this conversation without making the boys or the young men feel automatically that they are being, accused as if that they're going to do this in the future? How do you have the conversation without making them feel that way, feel defensive from
Sarah
the start?
Sarah did great. Yeah. She stuck with it. She had a moral a center to her discussion. She was great. Boys do react defensively if you come at them and say, all boys are potential rapists. I bridle when people say that. I don't like that image of us. Boys want love. Boys want care. Boys want relationships. They do have the penetrating instrument, but it doesn't make them potential rapists to my mind. But what she did was stuck with the discussion. Mm-hmm. And McGuire and I were talking about outside, about how much time you have to take to get to where you need to in these discussions.
Right. I mean, one of the issues is that we are talking sometimes, unfortunately, about sexual assault as it is, as if it is something that males are only perpetrators and females are only victims. When in reality, we know that, that women can also be perpetrators. Men can also be victimized, and there's definitely same-sex incidents that happen. So we need to realize that people are very concerned about boys being falsely accused, but they should also recognize that boys are also victimized. And when we have that, we draw that as a very male-female thing, then boys, of course, are going to get defensive and are also not going to recognize situations that may be dangerous for them. But we talk about sex a lot as if it's adversarial, as if it is boys, especially in a heterosexist kind of heteronormative kind of way, as it's boys trying to get sex from girls who are gatekeepers. And this is hugely problematic in terms of how we see people having sex rather than sexuality being something that people can share in an equal and loving way. And so boys may be feeling that in terms of defensiveness.
Lots more callers, so let's see if we can at least get to a couple of them. Rob is calling from Lexington. You're on the air, Rob.
Hi, thanks. It's Robin, but that's okay.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's okay. I've been listening to the show, and I feel concerned at the emphasis on sex education and sexuality and sexual relationships, because I feel like we're glossing over the fact that rape is not a sexual crime, it is a violent crime. And that we don't end rape by teaching kids sex education. We end rape by changing the way we raise boys, mostly, to believe that they can have and take anything they want. And I think to call rape a sexual crime is a conversation that we stopped having 20 years ago. And I'm surprised that this conversation has that tone to it.
Hmm. So. Robin, thank you for your call. Let me get some reaction.
So sex education is a somewhat misleading blanket term. And I agree that with a caller that what we are talking about is violence, and we are talking about many other aspects of that. I mean, so sex education is a blanket term that includes communication, that includes consent, that includes sort of our cultural experiences of masculinity and femininity, and, you know, how stereotypes about those can really lead young people astray. Sex education has to do with a lot of nuances on how people relate to each other. So it's really not, you know, just, teaching about, you know, anatomy and things like that. So I like to think that it does cover a lot of the more social issues that may came up and how people relate to each other.
Yeah. Well, my mind is coming back to the response that's been, you know, across social media to Dan Turner's letter asking the court for lenience on behalf of his son. And again, I'm turning back to one in particular, this open letter that was written by Whitney Fleming, who's a Huffington Post contributor, who basically said that, you know, to Dan Turner, that his attempt at marginalizing his son's assault only ensures another young man will do the same. And to that point, let me just turn to another caller, Rachel, who's calling from Sharon. You're on the air, Rachel.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Basically, I just wanted to say that there seems to be a larger culture, particularly parents who allow their children to just get away with any type of behavior. Granted, this is a very devastating situation with the young woman that was raped by this young man.
Rachel, I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to jump in on your call here because your cell phone line is very, very shaky. But I hear you saying that you believe that part of the problem is parents are creating a culture where children aren't necessarily learning right from wrong. I mean, Michael Thompson?
Parents, caring, loving parents, are always trying to teach right from wrong. It's that they often are embarrassed or scared or tentative about teaching right from wrong in detail in sexual relationships, which is why sex education has a role. Many parents just don't feel they can handle it. And we need to be talking to kids early and often about this.
Let's go to Aaron, who's calling from Reading. You're on the air, Aaron.
Hi. So it's kind of connected with the last caller, and I have a 5-year-old son, plus I also teach middle school, and so I have a bit of a range of perspective. And when I had my child, I sort of imagined that things would come naturally and he would just automatically be kind and considerate, and then I would kind of correct any bad behaviors. But what I was going to say is I'm surprised at how I have to actively teach him things. Like to say, like, go actively, okay, now you have to stop and go ask that child if they're okay, they just fell down.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have to actively say, you know, go over and see if they want to play with you. Or and so I think per what the previous caller and what the commentator was just saying, it's possible that maybe those considerations of sex education between parent and child could be easier to have if you already have a dialogue going of active education between parent and child or teacher and child, going of, it's not
right.
Sort of like correct the child when they've done something, you know, not nice. Or
yeah.
Whatever.
Erin, I'm going to take it back from you because we're fast running out of time, but I definitely hear your call for, you know, it's never too young to start talking about with your children the idea of respect and dignity for other people. But in the last minute that we have, like even less than, let me just get some final thoughts from both Michael and Megara. Your final thoughts here. I mean, we could go on forever, to be honest, but...
We could. We just need to talk to our young people. We need to give them more opportunities to wrestle with some of the complicated ideas of consent and communication. We need to give them an opportunity to ask questions, which hopefully they can ask questions of their parents. And we need other sources for them to get their questions answered. And we need to provide them with some guidance.
We need to talk to boys about their sexual hopes, their future pleasures, the capacity for relationship, empathy with others, and we have to talk frankly. They want to talk to us about it. The boys in my school are always asking for more conversation with adults about this. It is not true that boys don't want to talk about it. They don't want to talk about it with people who are uncomfortable talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and it's never too early to learn these lessons because, quite frankly, I just don't think that we can talk enough about treating each other with dignity and respect. Well, Megara Bell is the founder and director of Partners in Sex Education, a program based in Newton. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having this program.
And Michael Thompson, author of Raising Cain, Protecting the Emotional Life of Boys, and supervising psychologist at the Belmont Hill School. Thank you so much for joining us. And for all the listeners I couldn't get on the air, I'm very sorry about that, but send us your comments. Go to radioboston.org and comment there. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.